Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Inclusion Zone podcast. I'm your host, Mary Dolan. Welcome. Money, money, money. We all need it. Today, we're going to talk about something called an ABLE account. ABLE stands for Achieving a Better Life Experience. And we're going to learn about how these accounts can bring financial security and independence to people with disabilities. If you are a parent of a child or an adult with disability, if you're a brother, sister, or a friend of a person with disability, you need to know about ABLE accounts. If you're a person with a disability, you need to know about ABLE accounts. Because these could be real game changers. Little history. In 2014, President Barack Obama signed the law getting the ABLE Act on the books, and it allows people with disabilities to create tax-advantaged savings accounts. These savings accounts can be used to cover expenses such as education, housing, and transportation. And we're going to have some experts on the phone today who are going to tell us more about how the ABLE Act works and how you can get one. So today I've got Chris Rodriguez, who is Director of Public Policy at the National Disability Institute, joining, and also Mark Fries, who is a Senior Vice President at Merrill Lynch and handles special needs financial planning there. Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hello, Mary. How are you?
Excellent. Great. Hi, Mark and Chris. How are you today?
I'm doing good, Mary. Thank you so much for the opportunity for me to share some information about these transformative new accounts.
Well, it is really important for our community to know what's available to us. So let's dive right in, Chris. What is an ABLE account and why is it worth knowing about?
Absolutely, absolutely. So as you said, ABLE accounts are tax advantage investment accounts that help qualified individuals with disabilities and their families save for what's called disability-related expenses. Anybody can contribute into an individual's ABLE account. However, it's important to note that all contributions or all funds that are deposited into the account are not to exceed $15,000 in any given tax year. And we can talk a little bit more about that later. Additionally, the funds in the account, and this is what makes them so important, so special, is the fact that the funds in the account are actually not taken into consideration when determining the beneficiary's eligibility for means-tested federally funded benefits, such as things like Supplemental Security Income and Medicaid. It's also important to note that a person with a disability can only actually be the beneficiary of a single ABLE account at any given time. What really makes these ABLE accounts, as you said, a game changer, and that's something that I completely agree with, is the fact that, you know, over millions of individuals with disabilities and their families oftentimes depend on a wide variety of different public benefits for things like income, health care, food, and housing assistance. Perhaps not a lot of people know that a lot of times the eligibility for many of these public benefits, again, such as SSI, SNAP, and Medicaid, require meeting what's called a means or a resource test that actually limits that individual's eligibility if they have any more than a very modest amount of money. Many times they're not allowed to have any more than $2,000 worth of assets, including cash savings, retirement funds, and other things of significant value, or else they jeopardize those benefits, of which many of those benefits they rely on to cover their special health care needs and to help them live as independently as possible in the community.
Okay. So this sounds really interesting. Tax advantaged, is that the same as tax exempt?
So that's another great question. So we often refer to these accounts as tax-advantaged savings or investment accounts. And what that means specifically is that while the contributions that are contributed into a person's ABLE account have to be with post-tax dollars, these accounts are actually very similar to 529 college savings accounts, wherein the funds contributed are actually invested. and the beneficiary gets to choose among a variety of different investment options. Now, when those funds are invested, the interest earned on those investments is actually tax-free, and provided that the money is dispensed for the purposes of what's called qualified disability expenses, then it is actually dispersed tax-free as well.
Okay, that's good to know. That's very that's getting into the weeds already. So let's find out, what is the eligibility criteria for opening an ABLE account?
Right. And another great question. So unfortunately, these accounts aren't actually accessible to all people with disabilities, because there are eligibility criteria related to being allowed to open up an ABLE account. So the ABLE Act, the act that has established these accounts, actually limits eligibility to individuals with significant disabilities with an age of onset of that disability before the individual's 26th birthday. So what that basically means is the person, in order to be allowed to open up an ABLE account, would have had to first experience or have an onset of their disability before their 26th birthday. So that's kind of the first prong of eligibility. In addition to that, once the person is found to meet the age criteria, they also have to be either receiving or a beneficiary of SSI, Supplemental Security Income, or SSDI, Social Security Disability Insurance. So basically, what that means is that they've gone through the process, the determination process, through the Social Security Administration, and the Social Security Administration has established that they do, in fact, meet a certain level of severity related to their disability. So if they're currently receiving SSI or SSDI and their disability began before they turn 26, they're good to go. They can open up an ABLE account. Now, if they meet the age criteria, but for whatever reason, they are not currently receiving SSI or SSDI, they may still actually be eligible to open up an account, but they would need to get what's called a disability certification, and that just basically means that they go to a physician, and the physician signs on, basically documents the fact that they meet certain levels of severity related to their disability. So while that kind of takes you into the weeds a little bit, I think it's important to note that a couple things, actually. Despite what may sound like kind of stringent eligibility criteria, we've done some research here at the ABLE National Resource Center and at National Disability Institute, and find that there is conservatively around 8 to 9 million individuals with disabilities in the United States that are currently eligible to open up these accounts, which is very exciting. Even more so, we're working with certain members of Congress to try and go back and make certain changes to the law that would actually expand eligibility even further by raising that age 26 of onset up to age 46 and then hopefully beyond that, so that as many people with disabilities as possible can take advantage of these great benefits that are provided through being an ABLE account owner.
Okay. Well, that sounds okay. 26 is interesting. I think it'll be nice to see that raised a bit higher so we can be more inclusive. But 8 or 9 million people out there who are eligible and aren't yet taking advantage of it. That's something important for our community to know about. So let's talk about how somebody opens up one of these accounts.
Right. So what the federal law did when it was passed, as you said, in late 2014, is it allows states to build an ABLE program that then allows individuals to open up ABLE accounts. It's important to note that it doesn't actually obligate or require them to do so. So they have to determine if it's in their best interest to build one of these programs. I think as a result of the importance and the impact of this particular law, I think it's a reason that we found that over 45 states across the country have passed their own state ABLE legislation that has allowed them to build programs. And since the signing of the federal law, we've actually seen over 30 states not only pass that legislation, but have actually launched their ABLE programs. So as of today, there are actually 33 different states that have launched ABLE programs and are currently enrolling eligible individuals. Now, a couple things about that I want to make sure our listeners understand is you don't necessarily have to live in the state in which you enroll. So as an example, I have a brother with fairly significant intellectual and developmental disabilities that lives down in Texas. He meets the criteria that would allow him to open up an ABLE account. However, the state of Texas is still in the process of launching an ABLE program. Now, that doesn't mean that he can't open up an ABLE account, and in fact, he's gone to a different state to open it up. Now, a lot of people say, well, how exactly can you actually be enrolled in another state when you live across the country? And that's a very good question. And the answer is, these accounts, in order to make sure that they're as financially accessible to individuals as possible, actually are all done online. So you can get online no matter where you live in the United States, and you can actually enroll in an ABLE program and maintain the ABLE program all online. And that's something that folks, I think, don't always understand. We've heard of stories of folks going down to their local, say, Bank of America or Wells Fargo brick-and-mortar banking institution and asking and saying, hey, I want to open up an ABLE account. And because these are completely run online, the individuals have no idea what they're talking about. They've never heard of ABLE accounts. So it's important for folks to know that this is done online. And the reason for that is so that people have as much access to these accounts and so that they can keep the costs as low as possible so that folks can enroll.
Okay, that's great. Tell me about the self-determination side of this. Are these accounts that a person with a disability, him or herself, can set up for themselves? And when you talk about funds coming from others, can a person with disability contribute to their own account?
Right, another great question. So when Congress was, or when the disability community was advocating to Congress to pass this law and to develop some type of tool so that people with disabilities could save for their futures without having to jeopardize their very vital supports and services often provided by things like Medicaid, we wanted to make sure to build a tool that allows people with disabilities as much financial independence and autonomy as possible. And that's really what we've captured in ABLE. And the way that they've actually done that is by stating in the law that the account owner, the beneficiary, are the same person. So the funds actually belong to the person with a disability. Many people try and draw comparisons from ABLE accounts to special needs trusts, which do a similar thing in terms of being able to save money without jeopardizing benefits. But in many circumstances, and maybe Mark can speak to this a little later, let's say a third-party special needs trust, the person with a disability is the beneficiary, but they're not the account owner. They don't actually own the funds, and therefore they don't have as much independence over those funds. So I think that's another really, really amazing and very progressive attribute of an ABLE account. To your second question, we often talk about, you know, who can contribute into an ABLE account? Anybody. So that means friends, family, an employer, perhaps an employee kind of match situation can be happen. And certainly to your point, Mary, the person with the disability or the beneficiary themselves, perhaps as a result of employment, can contribute part of their earnings into their own ABLE account as well, so they can use their own money to save for their futures and not just have to depend on third-party contributions.
Okay, well, it sounds like a lot was put into this to make this something that is truly up and about the community. And what I want to find out, though, let me pull Mark in here, regarding how much money a person with a disability needs. That's something that you work on day in and day out. This account allows for more savings for those needs, but how do you help families figure out, and people with disabilities themselves, how do you help them figure out what the financial needs are going to be going forward?
Yes, Mary, thanks for that question. It's a great question. It's a hard question because the life of a special needs family is different. And I know firsthand because my son now is 22 years old and he is an autistic child. Now, an autistic adult, we never consider them adults yet, right, in our minds. And it's hard because you got to figure out, first of all, are the parents okay? Because if the parents aren't okay, then the child with special needs is not going to be okay. And so you're really planning for two very distinct lifetimes, which is a harder calculation to do. It requires a different set of skill sets. And so if you're going to talk to somebody about financial planning and you have a special needs child, it's imperative, in my opinion, that you get somebody that has the training and the knowledge to be able to handle special needs. The second piece is now you're planning for two lifetimes. You kind of figure out what their parents' situation is. And then with some calculations we're able to do, we can figure out how much money is going to be left over. And then the question is that enough? And we have a special needs calculator. We have a workbook, if listeners are interested in getting that we can send you to get you kind of started on that process. Some of the math behind it can be somewhat intimidating because in order to generate, example, a child that needs $50,000 a year in income, you need to have at least $1 million in assets. So it's a large sum of money that you need to have really to make sure your child's going to be okay.
Okay. Wow. That's a lot of zeros. That's a staggering amount. How does the ABLE Act fit into the formula of making sure that a person with disability is going to be able to live a life of dignity and independence? Is it the way, or is it just one of the tools that's available?
So I think it's a great program, very progressive program, probably one of the best laws to pass since the American Disabilities Act. So we're huge fans of it. And it's one of the buckets. So I always describe where you're going to get the money to be able to take care of your child. The first place you're going to get is you're going to apply for Social Security benefits. That'll be your first benefit. That takes care of basic needs, housing and food and things like that. That's your first bucket. The second bucket would be ABLE, which is wonderful. It allows you to put money aside. As Chris talked about very well, is a very tax-deferred account or tax-efficient account. So that's extremely favorable. And there's also another program, which Chris will talk about, ABLE to Work, which allows you to put even more money in if that person with disabilities is actually working. And the third bucket, as Chris talked about, would be your Special Needs Trust. And that is another vehicle that has really unlimited amount of money you can put in there. That money, just like the ABLE account, is not counted towards an asset of the person with a disability, so they can still qualify for Social Security and more importantly, Medicaid. But you're going to need all three buckets. And so we tell clients all the time, make sure that you apply for Social Security. Make sure you know when you have money put in this ABLE account. And make sure you set up the best, the special needs trust so that you're fully funded. And you know that your child, when you're no longer around, is going to be okay.
So, Chris, let me toggle back to you. So this ABLE to Work piece is really important for the community. And I understand that's something that's new that's been tagged on to the ABLE Act. Talk to me about the dollars that we're talking about people are able to contribute as part of this ABLE to Work Act, and also just the dollars that can be put into an ABLE account on an annual basis.
Right. Yeah, so we were excited to see that Congress is still very much invested in the ABLE Act, and I think the ABLE to Work Act wanted to try and put in some type of incentive for people that with disabilities that are pursuing employment, which I think is absolutely great. And what it allows is for as long as the beneficiary, the person with a disability, the account owner, has employment, they can actually exceed the annual contribution limit, which is currently set at $15,000. So stepping back for a second, again, anybody can contribute into a person's ABLE account, including the beneficiary themselves, but all contributions combined in any given tax year are not to exceed currently $15,000, right? So that's the max that you can put into account in any given year. What the ABLE to Work Act has done is it allows, provided that the beneficiary is employed, for them to put their own money through employment, their earnings, into the account above that $15,000 and to the degree that it almost actually doubles that cap. They can actually contribute up to about, I think it's $11,740 of their income into that account. It's equal to the federal poverty level, with that, whatever that is in the year prior to the year in which the contributions are being made. So that's extremely exciting for people with disabilities. It gives them some extra motivation to pursue employment opportunities, and it gives them some extra opportunity in terms of being able to contribute even more funds into that account to save for their long-term and short-term disability-related needs.
Yeah. What I'm wondering about, though, is how there must be some devil in the details. So talk to me about the fine print, because this sounds really great, but I'm worried that there's some catch about, you said you won't lose your Medicaid, you said you won't lose Social Security. Can you just talk a little bit more about that and assure me on that point?
Sure, absolutely. So there's a couple catches that people probably want to be aware of as it relates to the interaction between an ABLE account and contributions into an ABLE account and a person's eligibility for things like Medicaid and Social Security. I would say, number one, we have to remember that oftentimes when determining eligibility for these federally funded benefits, it's kind of a two-part system. One is they're going to look at your assets. Your resources, right? So that's really where ABLE comes in, to protect those assets and allow those assets in the ABLE account not to be counted towards the person's eligibility for Medicaid and Social Security and things like those. But they're also going to look at how much money you make, earned income, and ABLE has a difficult time protecting that. So it's important to note that even if a beneficiary contributes directly from their employer to the ABLE account, those dollars that they earn are actually still being taken in consideration with respect to earned income and what's called substantial gainful activity, which will be looked at and examined when determining their eligibility for things like Medicaid and Social Security. So it's really more of an asset building tool as opposed to something that might be able to protect somebody's earned income. But we're working on different pieces of legislation to try and address that, to provide a more comprehensive protection kind of thing for people with disabilities who are pursuing employment. Two, the second thing that I would note, for beneficiaries of ABLE, so ABLE account owners who are also receiving SSI, or Supplemental Security Income, of which not all ABLE account owners will actually be receiving SSI, but many will, they should be aware that when the account approaches, or I should say, when the account surpasses $100,000, then the cash benefit related to being an SSI beneficiary will be temporarily suspended until such time as the account falls back below that $100,000. Now, even though that is the case, no other benefits will be touched. And I think that's important to note, because a lot of people are actually eligible or receive their benefits through Medicaid by means of being eligible for SSI. So oftentimes people say, well, if I have over $100,000 in my ABLE account and my cash benefit related to my SSI is suspended, is my eligibility for Medicaid suspended as well? And the answer is no, it is not. The $100,000 limit to SSI is the only federally funded means test benefit that would be touched, and it's only touched if the account exceeds $100,000. Of which, Mary, as you can imagine, the first ABLE account was open less than 2 years ago. So we haven't really had to tackle this issue, because obviously at $15,000 a year, it's going to take another few years before we'll see the first ABLE account owner exceed $100,000. But this is certainly something that we're working with ABLE programs to make sure that they're aware of their responsibilities of letting their ABLE account owners know about this provision, especially once we see the accounts start to approach $90,000, $95,000, because, again, these are investment accounts. So just because, say, somebody shuts it down or stops contributing in at $99,000 doesn't mean that perhaps as a result of interest, it might not eclipse that $100,000 cap.
Right. Well, that's so, you know, this is a great tool for people with disabilities and their families. But this stuff is messy. This is really complicated. So talk to me about the ABLE Resource Center that you run, Chris, and then I want to ask Mark about the work he does to educate families and people with disabilities about the ABLE Act and the other buckets that he was talking about. So, Chris, what's the ABLE National Resource Center?
Absolutely. So the ABLE National Resource Center was founded and is managed by National Disability Institute. And we developed the center soon after the law was passed. So very early 2015, we got the center up and running. And it's a collaborative of over 25 of the country's largest and most prominent disability-related organizations that have really pooled their resources in order to accelerate the development and the adoption of these ABLE accounts nationwide. We do webinars, we do presentations, we have informative videos, we have Q&A very often, but we get the majority of our information out to the public through our website, and you can visit that at www.ablenrc.org. And we have all kinds of platforms on the website to provide information about ABLE accounts in general. In fact, we even have a map on the front page, and you can click on any state in the United States, and it will give you an update on where that particular state is with respect to launching their program. As I said previously, people can enroll in states outside of their own state of residency, so they'll have options. We wanted to build, and we built and launched a comparison tool that you can access through the website that would that will allow an individual to compare up to three ABLE programs side by side based on about 12 different characteristics that we think people might want to take into consideration when determining which ABLE account best meets their needs.
Okay. And what's that website again?
It's www.ablenrc.org.
Excellent. Okay, so if this is piquing your interest, that is the website that you should go to. And I just went on it a little bit ago, and I saw there's a lot of good questions and Q&A on there, frequently asked questions, and lots of other resources. And there are ways there to help you get going with an ABLE account. But let's turn this to Mark. Mark, do you help families with ABLE accounts? And what kind of assistance are you able to provide for families and people with disabilities?
Yeah, thank you, Mary. So we're kind of looking at the big picture and kind of a high level. And so ABLE account is certainly one thing we'd recommend. And Chris's group is excellent, and they have a lot of good webinars on that website, too, to listen to, and I participated on some of those. But the main thing for families is to get organized. And we have lots of resources that are available that are complimentary to get you started. We have a calculator to figure out how much money would it really cost to support that child with special needs. Because for most family members, I mean, the biggest and scariest thing is, you know, what happens to their family member with special needs when they're gone? And is there enough money? And do you have the not only the financial resources, but you have a team around them to help? Who's going to take care of housing? Who's going to take care of, you know, physical things need to be done? What about legal matters? What about, you know, trust and things like that? So you got to build a whole team, and we're very able to help people with that. There are also certain areas like a workbook we have, which kind of gets you organized. Where's all your stuff? What do you think you'll need? You know, how's ABLE going to fit into the program? Is there going to be enough money? And then the last thing we provide is an information packet on what's called a letter of intent, which is kind of a roadmap that the child with special needs, if they are able to, and the parents kind of put together themselves. And it kind of just talks about the daily things that need to be done. What's that child need? So if something did happen to the parents, somebody else would easily be able to take over, not easily, but try to take over and make sure that everything for that child with special needs was running smoothly.
That's great. And to reach you, Mark, and the Merrill Lynch group? The
best way
that?
Is just to call me. It's 202-659-6138. It's 202-659-6138. Or you can email me at Mark, M-A-R-K, little underscore sign, and then F-R-I-E-S-E, at ml.com. So it's Mark with a K, underscore sign, F-R-I-E-S-E, at ml.com. We can send out this information for you, and you'll be able to take a look at what we're offering.
That's terrific. I want to thank you both, Mark and Chris, for this excellent information and for taking the time to explain the ABLE Act to everyone. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Mary.
And that is the end of that podcast on the ABLE Act. And it's a really important one, so I hope everybody listen to this to conclusion and go online and learn more about it from the National Resource Center and give Mark a call too. All right, we're out of here. Bye.